Today, I'm interviewing my mom about the war on terror. My first question is, do you remember where you were during the 9/11 attacks? What was it like to experience this event in real time?
Okay, sorry, I thought you were going to say more. Yeah. yeah, I remember exactly where I was. So, back at that time, I used to have the Today Show on in my bedroom every morning when I was getting ready for work. And I had just gotten out of the shower and I went in my room to get dressed and I saw, like, you know, Matt Lauer at the time saying, you know, it appears that a small private plane has crashed into the Twin Towers, and or one of the buildings is Twin Towers. And I was like, oh my God, like, that's horrible. And then I, like, sat down to watch it, and all of a sudden, like, just very quickly, they started getting information and getting images. And then it was like, hold on. Oh yeah, actually that was what it was. So at that point, only one plane had gone in. But they did think it was a small private plane. Everybody thought it was an accident. And it was just like a horrible tragedy. And then as they were reporting on that, the second plane hit the other tower. And then it was like live, the reporters were like, oh my God, like, you know, the other building's been hit. This might not be an accident. So it was just sort of all, you know, revealing itself live as I sat there and watched. And I was like sort of transfixed, and I like almost forgot about getting ready for work. And I called your dad and I was like, you got to come in here. Like, you got to see this. And so we watched for a while, and it was very obvious, you know, that something was going on. But then, you know, we both had to go to work. So just kind of got ready with TV on, and we were sort of watching the mayhem and watching the smoke come out of the buildings and watching people, you know, trying to escape the Twin Towers. And then it was actually really horrific. I'm like hesitant to tell you this, but because as the cameras were rolling and the fire is billowing out of the top floors, you actually saw people falling out of the buildings. And in, like, later they kind of put it together that people were actually jumping because they couldn't get down. They couldn't get down the stairs, and the fire was so hot, and it was sort of like, I think a lot of people knew either they were going to like burn to death or jump. And I think it was maybe like a bit of a human instinct to just jump, even though obviously, you know, there are 100 stories up or whatever, like they were not going to live. And there was a lot of like recordings that came out at the end of like people on their cell phones and stuff, like calling loved ones and saying like, you know, I'm trapped, I can't get out. And all, because the planes, I don't know if you know this, but they went in like not at the top floor, you know, there were like 10 floors above, I think, the one plane. And so all those people were just trapped. And then obviously the building came down on itself. And so, you know, anybody above, none of them survived, and very few people below, honestly. And so as it was happening, you know, we eventually got ready for work. I remember getting in the car, turning on the news. I had like a half hour commute, and just listening to it and just being like horrified, because by then the plane had hit the Pentagon. And it was just kind of like, oh my God, like, we're being attacked. You know, it was like the reality of that, like, set in. And I worked in the hospital district on the west side at that point. But I had just left my job, like, less than a year before at the Jewish Federation building in downtown Chicago. And when I worked there, we were regularly getting terrorist threats, like that building was. And so, like, all the time, like, there would be bomb threats and we'd all have to exit and that kind of stuff. So that was just kind of like, I worked there for, gosh, I can't remember now, 4 or 5 years. And that was just part of, like, life there. But my thought at this point, we didn't know who was attacking us. We just knew our country was under attack. We didn't know who, we didn't know why, we didn't know what was, you know, the agenda. And I just thought, oh my gosh, like, my friends that work in the Jewish Federation building they should not go into that building today. You know, like this is like, I thought a 13-story building full of Jewish people would be a target potentially for, you know, whoever might be doing the attacks. And so I remember calling my friends and saying, like, you're not going to the office, right? And a lot of them were just kind of in denial, and they were like, what? Yeah, I was going in the office. Like, it's fine. You know, like, so people's reactions to the whole attack were really interesting, you know? And then when I got to work, my boss, who was a psychiatrist, was also like kind of operating in denial. You know, we were all, of course, the rest of us on the unit were talking and like, oh my God, did you see what happened and what's going on and who's attacking us and why? And then we knew another plane had crashed by then in Pennsylvania. We didn't really understand the story of that one until it all came out later. But I remember somebody wheeled a TV into like the main area of the, I worked in a psych, at Ellison psych ward. And, we were kind of watching and even the clients were watching at that point. And my boss was basically like, okay guys, time for our staffing meetings. And we were like, wait, what? We're having staffing meetings? We're like being attacked. And she was like, yeah, we're having staffing meetings. Like she just kind of like ignored the whole thing. And she made us all go down. And you know, my friend Cindy that passed away that I talk about a lot, like, I remember her and I were like whispering, like, she is nuts. Like she is just pretending like nothing's going on. And we went down and we started holding these staffings, and this was before smartphones. So we couldn't check or, you know, we just had to like, kind of like on breaks, like sneak back to the unit and be like, what's happening? Cause for all we knew by this point, maybe Chicago was going to be attacked. You know, it's the third largest city. They were attacking New York. They were attacking DC. It felt reasonable to assume that we might be a target, that like LA and Chicago might also be a target, you know? So, not that I was in the city, you know, I was far enough on the west side. I didn't feel concerned for my own personal safety, but certainly I felt concerned for a lot of people I knew who worked downtown. And so, yeah, we were just kind of like back and forth checking. And then, the other thing I really remember about that day or that day in the next few days is like going home with your dad, and like we just sat on the couch and we were just basically glued to the TV watching the coverage mostly of the Twin Towers. And well, I'll even back up to say, like, as the day went on, it just got more and more horrific, because it was like first the buildings had been attacked, then we heard about the people jumping out. Then it was like, oh my God, oh my God. Like, I remember this reporter literally was saying that, and he's like, this is horrific, this is horrible. The building has collapsed. So it kind of like imploded in on itself once just so much fire and whatever melted the structure. And so when the first building collapsed, it was like, holy crap, like thousands of people are gonna die, you know, because we knew not that many people had gotten out yet. And the other thing is like, emergency personnel had rushed in and they were, you know, climbing up like the 80 stories to get people out. So tons of police and firefighters at that point had gone into the building, and then it suddenly collapsed. So it was like, we knew that was going to be like really bad. And then the second building collapsed as the day went on. And then you just for days, we sat and watched the news and watched the coverage of the rubble basically. And they were digging and digging and digging and digging and trying to find anybody. And I don't know that they found any survivors. Like, I literally don't recall anybody. And just like watching the news and praying, like, please find somebody, anybody. Like, and then as like, you know, day two, day three, by day four, you kind of knew like, there's just no chance anybody's alive under there anymore. It was just awful. It was so sad. You know, I've later been involved with some PTSD research out of the 9/11 day. And what one thing they found was the people who were able to escape and like keep running. So people were like running for blocks and blocks and blocks because the smoke, the amount of smoke that was just coming, you know, billowing down the streets was massive and people couldn't breathe. And, you know, the people that were able to flee are the ones that did not end up with PTSD, but the ones that were kind of like trapped, like maybe they were trapped in a building nearby or something like that. So the people that were like trapped, not, you know, not in the actual rubble, but trapped nearby and couldn't actually go anywhere are the ones that tended to get the PTSD. There's something about like human bodies being able to move and be mobile in trauma that reduces your chances of PTSD. And that was really a lot of that research has come out of the, out of 9/11. And you know, I think, you know, that the family I live with when Grandma and Papa moved, you know, he was a firefighter, Boston firefighter. So he knew tons of, you know, firefighters in New York, and a lot of, in the days that followed, a lot of firefighters from around the country mobilized and went there to help, you know, in the rescue, in the recovery effort, and hopefully, you know, they were all, they were hoping to rescue people. And so he knows so many guys that went there, and a lot of people that were there and were searching in the rubble in the, you know, week or two that followed, like a lot of them ended up with permanent like lung problems and stuff because of breathing and all that, you know, toxicity, the smoke and the, you know, just basically whatever was in the air from the building, you know, imploding, the concrete and all that kind of stuff. But then the other thing that was just really sad, like they did a lot of exposés in the days that followed on the different first responders that had gone into the building and obviously didn't come back out once the building collapsed, you know, and just doing all the stories. I remember there was some like reverend cop or firefighter or something that got like a lot of publicity, and it was just such a sad story. And one of the big things to happen to New York after 9/11 that I think a lot of people don't, or your age people probably don't know about, is like so many first responders died that they then had a shortage of firefighters for sure, and to a certain extent police officers, because so many of them died. And that, it was really sad. And then I feel like there was another part to the question from, oh, I know, the other thing was just about that fourth plane. Do you, 'cause that story kind of came out later after that day.
Are, I know a little bit, but can you elaborate?
Yeah, do you know like the Todd Beamer part or whatever? No. So what happened was, because obviously there were cell phones, and there was so much immediate news coverage of the Twin Tower, of what was happening with the Twin Towers, that the plane that ended up going down in Pennsylvania, the passengers on that plane, their family, their loved ones called them. Oh, I'm trying to remember now how, oh no, I know what it was. The passengers called the family. Okay. So the passengers knew that obviously the terrorists got up and they took over the cockpit. Okay. So now the passengers know that their plane is being hijacked. Prior to 9/11, anytime a plane was ever hijacked, you know, it wasn't like purposely hijacked to crash into something. It was hijacked to like take people hostage, right? So, you know, the assumption of the people on that plane was that they were being held hostage, because obviously nobody thinks, I mean, nobody at that point thought, like, it didn't seem obvious that terrorists would purposely kill themselves, right? Like, they know they're on a plane to fly, to crash into something, they know they're, it's a suicide mission, right? So that wasn't, like, common or known or whatever. So the people on that plane, all they knew was that they had been hijacked, and so a lot of them snuck phone calls to loved ones. And what happened was, is the loved ones were like, oh my God, you're going to die, because they've already hijacked two other planes and flown them into the Twin Towers. And so, you know, and then they found out they crashed one in the Pentagon. I'm pretty sure that's how it happened. I don't know exactly all the details, but basically the people on that plane, the passengers realized, we're going to die regardless, and maybe we can do something to prevent a lot of other people from dying. And so there, like, one guy in particular that's been really featured is this guy, Todd Beamer. And he, like, sort of organized the passengers to attack the terrorists and take down the plane early so that it wouldn't hit its target. They didn't know what the target was. I think later it came out it was supposed to be the White House, but I don't know that they ever knew that. And like, there's like the whole like kind of sad part of the story is like he, you know, called his wife and he said that like, I love you and all this. And then the last thing she heard him saying is to the other passengers, like, let's roll. And then they went and they attacked the terrorists and they took down the plane in like a field in Pennsylvania and obviously saved a ton of lives. So like they're, you know, celebrated as American heroes for doing that.
All right, the next question is, do you know anybody who was personally affected by this event in 9/11?
Yeah, I know a lot of people because I grew up in New Jersey and Boston. You know, I knew a lot of people who knew a lot of people. You know, one of my friends from high school, one of my, not one of my better friends, but I went to a very small high school, so we knew everybody. This guy, Dave Foley, who I still am in touch with a little bit, you know, he was in the Twin Towers that day, and his office was there. So he knew a lot of people that died, and he talked about it to me one time and just, like, how awful it was. And at the time, you know them as, like, Teddy Moon's parents, but you're, like, the people we did the nanny share with, I mean, this was all obviously before you were born, but we were just good friends with them. And he also grew up in Long Island, so he also knew a ton of people in New York. And his best friend's husband died in the Twin Towers, and I had met him at their wedding and stuff. And so I remember that Woody went to New York for a few weeks. He stayed out there with her for a couple weeks because she was just devastated. Like, you know, they were like basically newlyweds, they just started their lives together, and like hear her like 25-year-old husband, you know, is all of a sudden dead, and it was just really tragic. So that was really hard. And I also knew people who were in Boston, and so the planes were hijacked out of Boston. I know the Pennsylvania one was, I feel like one or two of the other ones were, there was a couple that were like out of Boston. And then I knew people who were involved in, what's it called, border control there. And they all had like a lot of guilt because it was sort of like, how did this get past us? You know, that kind of thing. So yeah, there was a lot of fallout, a lot of really sad stories that came out of it. Oh, I remember too, there was like one neighborhood, like, you know how, well, actually you might not know this, but like here in Chicago, there's like one neighborhood that is sort of known for all the cops and firemen live there, Edgebrook. So there was like a similar neighborhood in New York, and it was like, it was just devastated. Like, you know, almost like every other house, somebody had lost somebody in 9/11. That whole neighborhood was so impacted because so many of them were first responders and died. And it was just like, you know, hundreds of people in this one little area had died that day, because I think overall it was like 2,200 people or something.
All right, the next question is, did you think the Bush administration did a good job following the terrorist attacks?
So in the days right after the terrorist attacks, I did. You know, I was never a fan of George Bush. I did not vote for George Bush. I thought he was sort of incompetent and not the sharpest tool in the shed, and mostly got in off of his dad's name and all that kind of stuff. But I will say that I felt he was very presidential in the wake of 9/11. You know, I think he did a good job of like bringing the nation together, of showing leadership, of trying to help people feel safe. And I felt like that was good. I mean, I felt like that was a good response, and it was a needed response. And, you know, we all felt good about it. I think as time went on, what I did not like about the Bush administration's handling of the situation was like the Patriot Act. So the Patriot Act, are you familiar with it?
Sort of, yeah.
Okay. So it was basically like, you know, I'm going to oversimplify it, but like basically like the government's getting more leeway with basically being able to spy on its own citizens, you know, being able to listen into phone calls and read emails and see personal, like, internet searches and stuff. And it was even, I mean, if you think about it, it was even cleverly named the Patriot Act, because the Bush administration was very intentionally using 9/11 to gain a lot more power and to really take away individual freedoms. And so a lot of people were concerned about it, but more people were scared. Excuse me. There was still, like, there was, you know, there definitely was a feeling of dread and fear for, in really months, I would say, after the attacks, that it was going to happen again, especially living in Chicago. You know, we did think maybe, like, it could happen in Chicago still. And there was a sense of, like, you just don't know. You don't know when it's going to happen. It could happen anytime. So a lot of people were scared for a really long time. And so the idea that we give up some of our freedoms, but maybe they will catch, you know, Al-Qaeda as a result of this, was, like, very appealing to most people. So the Patriot Act was popular at the time. Most people thought, like, this is a good thing. You know, personally, I did not. I was concerned about it. I mean, obviously, I wanted Al-Qaeda caught, and I wanted, you know, to feel safer. But I definitely had concerns, because it was like, you know, I think in throughout history, a lot of dictators have risen by manipulating mass fear to, you know, get people to give up freedoms. And it just felt like that, you know, it felt a little like reminiscent of like Hitler in World War II to me, where it was like, okay, we're gonna, you know, we're gonna ask you to give up your freedoms for, but we're saying it's for your own safety, but like still we were giving up our freedoms. And then, you know, it takes a lot of trust, like, you know, okay, well now they, yeah, they're saying that they're listening in on all this to find terrorists, but, you know, if at one point or another they decide to, you know, okay, people who have like this kind of ethnicity or that kind of background or whatever, you know, they could use that information to find people, right? And it sounds a little like paranoid and conspiracy theory, but like that's what happened to Jewish people in World War II, right? So it's like, it's not like super out of the realm of like possibility that that could happen. So, you know, and again, I thought the fact that they intentionally named it the Patriot Act seemed like sneaky, right? Like it's like they're trying to make it sound like, oh, it's very patriotic, and if you're against this, you're not a patriot, kind of a thing. And that was sort of the rhetoric at the time. You know, a lot of people were like, what? You're against it? What, you want Al-Qaeda to win? It's like, no, I don't want Al-Qaeda to win, but I'm a little concerned about giving up so much, you know, personal, you know, information, you know, giving so much control to the government.
Yeah. And then sort of going off that, what were some of the other big changes you noticed in American society as a result of the attacks, other than the Patriot Act and like the general fear of terrorists?
Yeah. I mean, definitely for a time, I think it brought the country together, as crisis tends to do. And for a while, people were sort of like nicer to each other and more appreciative and all that kind of stuff, which is like the good thing that comes out of a crisis, you know. I think that the really unfortunate thing, I mean, I don't think, I know that the really unfortunate thing that came out was there was just a massive like backlash against Middle Eastern Americans, Middle Eastern people, Muslims. You know, mosques were attacked, people were, you know, just a lot of racial, like, hate crimes sprung up clearly at that group, you know, aimed at that group. But I remember being on airplanes around that time and hearing people in the seats around me, like, make comments if somebody looking, Middle Eastern looking, I'm just saying like darker features or whatever, got on the plane, people would actually get anxious, literally. And they would be like nervous and whispering and like, oh my God, I wish they would get them off this plane. I mean, it was really bad. Like it was like crazy. And certainly if anybody was like dressed in like traditional Muslim garb or had a turban or whatever. It was like, you know, people were really anxious of them and really like mean, nasty, just racist, just, you know, out and out racist. So that was really depressing to see. And just in general, like how, I mean, it's one of the sad things about like the Taliban was just how like the Muslim religion, which is actually a really peaceful religion, like was just got demonized in, you know, popular American culture as being like, you know, all Muslims are terrorists kind of thing, which is like super far from the truth. But that was what kind of came out of the whole thing, you know, I mean, because it was like the idea of a jihad, you know about that, right? So in Muslim, like a holy war is called a jihad. And so the Al-Qaeda claimed that their attack on the U.S. was their jihad. So they, you know, they definitely tied it to Muslim religion. And so that's why people were, you know, got the really wrong idea about Islam and all that kind of stuff.
All right. And then what do you think of the idea of a global war on terror instead of a war in a particular country?
So when Bush came out with that concept, global war on terror, like I remember it was controversial. You know, they were sort of talking about it in the news because I don't think there had ever been anything really like that before. You know, before this, a war was always against a particular country, mm-hmm. you know, and so the idea that, so we knew that it wasn't really a country, you know, we knew, or well, at least we thought right after 9/11 that like, we knew it was Al-Qaeda was claiming it. We knew that they were connected with the Taliban, but it wasn't like an act. We knew that like Afghanistan was sheltering and protecting Taliban and Al-Qaeda, but it wasn't really clear. It wasn't like actually the Afghani government, right? So it was sort of like, we can't really go to war with the government, with the country of, but we can go to war in that country claiming, like looking for the terrorists, I think was kind of the general like idea of the global war on terror. And then it sort of gave the Bush administration a little bit more freedom to like potentially go into other countries, which obviously it did at some point. And so it was interesting and a little confusing, but I think in general, like most people were behind it. And I was like, okay, like, I guess this is the way to go because, you know, it was obvious it wasn't really a country at that point to attack. And it was like, you know, obvious that people wanted harm, you know, there was a group of people out there that wanted to harm Americans and they did, and they harmed a lot of Americans in that day. So, you know, it seemed like it made a certain amount of sense at the time. I think as the years dragged on, it got really murky and confusing and, you know, kind of like, what are we doing kind of thing.
Yeah. And then what do you think about the U.S. holding terrorists in the military facility in Guantanamo Bay?
That I was always very concerned about and very against because it felt so. Do you know much about it, really, or?
Not particularly, no.
So what they were doing is if they captured terrorists, they would ship them to Guantanamo Bay because there were different laws, basically, there than if they had brought them to a court in America, I mean, in the States, mm-hmm. Because they were then, it was like military tribunal or something like that. And so they just have different rules. And so one of the things that was concerned right away of like civil rights groups was that they could do state-sponsored torture, basically. There were certain torture techniques that were allowed to go on at Guantanamo Bay that would not have been allowed if they brought them to the country, to the States. So it was very clear that that's why they put them there. Very shiesty, you know, in my opinion. Most Americans at that time, and I had this argument with many, many people back in that time period, most people were totally okay with it because they were like, torture the beep out of those guys if we need to, but we need to get information. We need to know where Osama bin Laden is. I mean, there was definitely a sense for a long time, a few years, that like it was going to happen again. It could happen any minute. You know, people were on eggshell or, you know, on like pins and needles about it. And so a lot of people felt like it's okay, like torture them because we need to get this information. Now, I, again, because of my like background, mental health and PTSD and all that, like I know the research on torture clearly shows that it's not effective. It gets more false information than accurate information and all that kind of stuff. So I personally was very against them being held at Guantanamo Bay, and I, you know, I supported like Amnesty International, who was trying to get that change and that kind of thing. And then when Obama was running, one of his campaign promises that I was really excited about was that he was going to close Guantanamo Bay and start having, you know, captured terrorists brought and tried in the States instead of tried there. And when he took office, it was one of the big disappointments that a lot of like those of us who are more liberal like really felt with him was like he didn't do that right away. I think eventually he did, but it took a really long time. And like he just didn't, I don't know. I don't know what that was about because he seemed very sincere. And I always wondered if it was like, okay, he found out something that the rest of us didn't know once he took office, you know, top secret kind of stuff, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
So anyway, that was eventually it was closed, finally.
All right. Do you remember when the video of Daniel Pearl, the Wall Street journalist, was released? Have you ever watched this video? And what was the general reaction from people you talked to and or news publications at the time?
Yeah, I do remember it. I never did watch it. Obviously, generally, people were horrified. It definitely added fuel to the fire of people who were, you know, just sort of out for blood for, you know, Al-Qaeda, Taliban, terrorists, all that kind of stuff. It was really horrific. The one thing I do remember about it was hearing a reporter talk about watching it, and she was talking about the fact that she had watched it because she felt like, as a journalist, it was important for her journalistic integrity to watch the video. And she did. And she said that she was just basically sort of scarred for life as a result of watching it, is basically the gist of what she was saying. She was talking about the fact that once you've seen something, you can't unsee it. And so it's one thing to like hear about something horrific and maybe even imagine it in your mind. But when you see it, it then becomes like imprinted on your brain in a different way. And there's no clearing that out, really. So I was happy to have heard that interview because I thought she made a really good point. And I was glad I never did watch it. But it certainly, you know, went sort of like quote unquote viral back then. A lot of people did watch it, and it was really just pretty, you know, disturbing. I mean, you know what happened to him and everything, right? Yeah. So it was just really, really awful. His poor family was being interviewed on the news a lot. It was horrible.
Mm. Mm-hmm. And then when the war in Iraq started, did you watch the televised coverage, and what was the reaction to the start of this war?
Yeah. I mean, it was obviously very controversial, whether or not to even go to war. And I do remember even all the coverage around that, you know, they were showing these sort of grainy images of what looked like could be bunkers to hold like weapons of mass destruction. And, you know, it was, I mean, there were a few people in Congress and Senate who voted against the war. But even some of the more like liberal left-leaning people like Obama and Hillary Clinton and stuff like did vote for it, you know, and I think later kind of publicly regretted that. But, you know, at the time there was still a lot of fear, a lot of like, we need to do something to keep safe. We, you know, knew that Saddam Hussein really, like, kind of, lack of a better way of saying it, like, had it out for us. And we knew that, or we thought that he might have weapons of mass destruction and could therefore do, you know, like, you drop a nuke on a city and, you know. So I think it was really a fear-based decision to go to the war. And then I think you know that, like, they never found any. So that was just kind of false information. Mm. But the first days of the war, you know, the first couple weeks or whatever, again, it was sort of similar to 9/11. I remember sitting and watching the news for hours on end. And I think that there was hope that it was going to be a quick thing. Like, we were going to go in and, like, get Saddam Hussein and pull him out of power and then, like, be out. And as the months dragged on and that didn't happen, you know, then it started, like, feeling very familiar, like Vietnam. You know, a lot of people started making that comparison and stuff. And at that time, actually, I don't know if you know this, but your grandfather, my dad, who was a medic in Vietnam, and so he had seen a lot of blood and gore and came back with some PTSD for sure. But his PTSD really sort of reignited, I guess, if you will, as the months, it wasn't right away with the Iraq War. I think it was like maybe 3 months in when it started feeling more like Vietnam, and he started actually like having flashbacks. So he would like smell the blood and hear the sounds of gunfire and, you know, have flashbacks of scenes and stuff. And he ended up having to be hospitalized for it, in the psych hospital for a few days to like stabilize out of it. And so, you know, I wonder, I mean, he can't be the only one, right? Like, I mean, I think it probably triggered a lot of people. And then, you know, two of my cousins ended up in that war, you know, Amy's husband, Steven, and then my cousin, Scott, you've only met a couple times, but they both served in that war. So it really started to affect my generation, you know, because there was a fair amount of people my age that were going over there and fighting.
Mm. Then Osama bin Laden was killed in 2011. This is following a near decade-long search for him. Do you remember if his death was celebrated, and did it provide relief that the war on terror should or maybe is going to be ending soon, since he was the face of the terrorist opposition?
Yeah, definitely. You know, it's interesting. I'm just remembering. Pretty sure your dad and I were in Europe when it happened, too. I think we were in Austria. It was definitely celebrated. I mean, it felt like amazing. You know, I mean, this guy had, you know, eluded the world's best, you know, professionals or whatever searching for him for so long. I mean, you'd almost like forgotten about it, you know, and it was just sort of like out of the blue, like, wait, what? And they found him, they got him, you know. It was amazing. It felt like really big, really huge. I think that, you know, it was nice that it was like a special ops kind of operation rather than like a big bombing that would have killed innocent people and that kind of thing. So it felt like a victory in that way too. And I think we definitely all had hope that it would lead to ending the war on terror. But, you know, God, I hadn't thought about this in years, but so what was interesting is we were in Austria when the news hit. So obviously time difference in that. I feel like maybe the news hit America when we were asleep and then we woke up and we saw it and we were like, oh my God. But you know what we were actually afraid of? Oh my gosh, I just remembered this about 9/11. Do you know Auntie Elena and Uncle Kermit got stuck in Hawaii for 10 days? Because they were in Hawaii when 9/11 happened. Mm-hmm. And then the airports were shut down for weeks. I don't know if you know that. And so they literally couldn't fly home. And, you know, he had a stepdaughter, you know, Karina, kind of know about her. Yeah. So she was, like, back in the States because they were there on their honeymoon. And, and they couldn't get home to her. I mean, she was being taken care of by family, but still it was, like, super stressful. Anyway, sorry, I digress. So
you guys were scared about not being able to.
Yeah, that's exactly it. We were scared because we thought, because the worry was, okay, the U.S. got Osama bin Laden. Is there then going to be retaliation, right, from Al-Qaeda or Taliban? Yeah. Are they going to bomb something or attack something and therefore airports are all shut down again and blah, blah, blah. And you guys were little and Aunt Janet was staying with you. Mm. And I think you were like 1 and 3 or something. You were, guys were really little. Mm. Maybe 2 and 4. So anyway, yeah, we were a little scared about that, but nothing like that happened. We got home and it was fine. Mm. But, you know, just to give you an image of like, that's what life was like, you know, it was sort of like, you know, like now you probably understand with the pandemic, it's like, oh God, like if another virus came out, everybody would freak, right? Mm. So it was like kind of anything that was sort of like terrorist related would kind of cause a big like freak out, you know.
And then the war in Afghanistan officially ended in December of 2014, but troops remained in Afghanistan. Did this feel like a true ending to the war?
No. It felt weird, confusing. It was sort of like, wait, like, why are we all of a sudden deciding? I mean, I know why, right? Because sort of by then, politically, it was an unpopular war. You know, it was popular in the beginning because it was sort of like, yeah, go in there and keep us safe. But by the end, it was sort of like, why are we still there? We're not doing anything. We're not really like making much progress. It didn't feel like it had much to do with America after a while anymore. And so it just sort of felt like, okay, politically, it's ending and whatever. And then a lot of people were then confused. Why are we keeping troops in? And that kind of thing. And so, you know, and then obviously they've since then even pulled the troops out. And then, I mean, which the sad part is, well, let me just say this. It's tricky, right? Because as the United States, we're one of the most powerful countries in the world. You know, are we the world police? No. But how do we decide who to be that for and who not to? And I think that was one of the big lessons in Vietnam, was like, we tried to go in as the world police and we couldn't do it. And we just lost a lot of lives and didn't really help much in, you know, in a way. And so I think that like, it was feeling like that way with Afghanistan. And then a lot of people were like, we just got to get out of there. We can't like save everybody. But, you know, sadly, since leaving Afghanistan, the Taliban basically immediately took over. And, you know, particularly for women of that country, it was really horrific because they really have horrific treatment of women. And, you know, it's just really sad what's happened in that country since, especially for women, you know. Mm. And the troops being there was obviously protecting some people to a certain extent. So it's really sad.
Yeah.
But it's also like, where do we draw the line and how do we, you know, it's very complicated and tricky. It's not easy at all.
All right. Any thoughts on the ending of the war in January of 2019, to finish off this conversation?
The ending of the Afghan war, you're saying? I mean, I guess just kind of like what I was just saying, it's like, you know, it does make me sad. Because I know that people have really suffered as a result of us leaving the country. And, you know, there is a little bit of that same sort of sense, like I was saying, for Vietnam, of like, well, why did, you know, the Americans that did lose their lives over there, it kind of feels like, well, what was the point if we were just going to pull out and the Taliban was going to take over anyway? But then there's the whole like, but how do you like, what's our other option? Just staying there forever, you know, like, so it's tricky. And I think what's interesting, not interesting is maybe not the right word, but like what it points to now is with this whole like Ukraine situation, right? It's like, I think it'd be easy to sort of simplistically look at it and say, okay, we need to go in there and stop Russia and whatever. But it's like, it's that same issue, right? Of like, what countries do we go into? You know, who do we assist and who do we not? And how do we, you know, and obviously, like, it's a little different because we know Russia has the military capability and nuclear weapons and stuff. And we know that that would probably lead to like a much larger war. But, you know, it's in a way a similar issue of like, what countries do we go in and help? Which ones do we don't? And it's just not a it's just not a simple answer or solution in any way.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that the whole thing with the war on terror is also really complicated because there are still terror groups out there. And what do we do?
Awesome. All right. Thank you.
Okay.